From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. Happy Friday to you. Coming up, the Teachers Union in Los Angeles has agreed to meet with school district officials on Monday to hopefully avert a strike. We'll hear from both sides later in the show. Plus, you can earn a little side cash by renting out your car to strangers. Yeah, it's a thing. We'll explain. But first, it's State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. This week, a farewell to Governor Jerry Brown. After 16 years as the state's chief executive, broken up by a few decades there in the middle, Brown is our longest-serving governor. But what will be his legacy? With us is Ben Adler, Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio. Happy Friday, Ben.
And to you, Megan.
And we are expecting John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. We had a bit of a trouble connecting with him, so he may pop in later in the show. But Ben, we're talking about the legacy of a governor who says that governors don't have legacies. You went to speak with him at his Colusa County ranch recently. Of course, the governor known for sometimes being gruff and abrupt, sometimes being long on esoteric references. But if you had one word to describe Brown's tenure, what would it be?
I'm going to pick a word that sounds overly obvious at first blush, but then it has many different layers. And that word is governor. And that's in multiple senses of the word. He really did govern this state, the state that had been accused and mocked as being ungovernable for years. He was able to get the state out of its $27 billion budget deficit. Right now, the nonpartisan legislative analyst pegs the state to have a $23 billion surplus at the end of the current fiscal year. And then there's this other sense, too, that I'm going to let Jerry Brown himself explain from my exit interview with him.
The governor, in keeping with the notion of what a governor is, it's to hold the rate of change to a certain level. That's what governors do. A governor in an engine keeps the engine from running out of control, and that's exactly what the governor has to do.
Speaking of engines, we were driving on a golf cart through his ranch in the rolling Colusa County foothills, and we had a fun little tour of the area, as did John, who was up there as well. So I think in the two senses of, look, he governed the state, and he had a lot of luck, right? The economy boomed, and he had a majority vote budget rule, whereas Schwarzenegger had a two-thirds requirement of the legislature to get to a budget. But he did show the state was governable, and he intended to be a governor on the spending of the state legislature.
All right. We are now joined by John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, on the phone. And John, it's your turn. What is your one word for Brown's tenure and why?
Well, I'm going to take the last 8 years, since I'm not sure whether you want 8 or 16. But I think for the last 8 years, I would call it perspective, Megan. I mean, I don't think that any governor has ever seen the cause and effect of governing California and state government more than Jerry Brown has. Time and again, you would hear him talk about what he saw in the first terms from 1975 to 1983 and how it didn't work and how he came back to fix it, whether it was the budget, whether it was criminal justice reform, which we wrote about this morning in the paper, any host of issues. I think the perspective of having been through those many eras of California governing, I think really, really shaped what he did here in Sacramento.
And John, what would you say is the biggest difference between those two Browns and what that perspective gained him?
Well, I have to admit, I wasn't here for the first two. I was still in high school, blissfully watching Governor Brown. But I think if you talk to a lot of people, you'll see that the word that comes to mind for me is focus. Jerry Brown admits it himself. He was a young man in a hurry in those first 8 years. He ran for president twice in that time frame. And, you know, he wasn't married. He's talked about then if I'd been married. And I think a lot of people credit the First Lady and Gus Brown with a lot of the focus that the governor's had. I think age and focus really have provided a remarkable change here. Plus, I would say really quickly, the governor talked a little bit when I talked to him last time about this notion that he's been the adult in the room in Sacramento. And certainly he has come back to be seen as an elder statesman, as a guy who knows how government should work and can work. I think focus, really, though, is the big change from when he was governor before.
Ben, when you spoke to Governor Brown, you chose to focus more on the things that he didn't do. But before we get to those, let's talk about the positives. What would you say are his top two lasting accomplishments in the state?
Well, he would certainly focus on, in addition to the budget deficit, which I think everyone focuses on, he would focus on climate change and he would focus on criminal justice reform. Those are two areas that have been near and dear to his heart that he has put a lot of time and energy into. On climate change, extending the state's cap and trade greenhouse gas emissions reduction system. He also presided over contentious debates with the oil industry and in terms of setting some future goals. And generally, although not always, he came out on top of those. On criminal justice, you know, something he did very early on in his governorship to help in some ways balance the budget, he shifted control over and responsibility for low-level offenders from state prisons to county jails, and funding for it as well went to the counties. And then he later in his governorship was able to push through some other changes, including particularly ballot measures and Proposition 57, which, you know, as John can talk about too, having just worked on criminal, you know, done the criminal justice legacy story as well. So I think those two things, and I mean, it's a long, much longer list than two. And you have to, you know, that was one reason I tried to talk with him about some of the things he didn't get to, because there's been so much discussion over all that he did do. But it is inescapable. His accomplishments are lengthy.
And John, just reviewing his accomplishment with the budget, when Governor Brown returned in 2011, California was facing a $27 billion deficit. That turned around under his stewardship into a $15 billion reserve with even more socked away in rainy day funds. So how did Brown manage to close that gap?
I don't think that Jerry Brown would mince words on this. I think he knows the economy saved California's budget. It's not to say that he won't say he had some good stewardship, and certainly asking voters to increase the size of the rainy day fund. And you're right, there are two different funds here. There's about $14, $15 billion in that longer-term reserve. There's as much as another $14 billion in unrestricted money that Newsom and the new legislature will look at come in just a matter of weeks. But the economy rebounded. Brown certainly helped champion a ballot measure in 2012 to raise taxes on the most wealthy. That certainly was a big part of this. So I think he would be honest and point to all of that. But I want to tell you one quick thing that people overlook about this governor in terms of the budget process here in Sacramento. Jerry Brown has had a remarkable run at framing the problem and framing the issue in a way that gets ahead of the legislature. And the key way that I've noticed over the years is he has been able to frame what is revenue that was expected and what revenue was unexpected. And every time he's been able to frame a lot of money as unexpected revenue, he's kept the legislature from spending it on long-term programs, one-time things versus long-term things. That is a phenomenal change, I would argue, in the way budgets are put together in the state.
I'm talking with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler and LA Times' John Myers about the legacy of outgoing Governor Jerry Brown. And Ben, now to the things that you talked about with Brown that he was not able to accomplish. He didn't try to reform the state's tax laws. There's a high dependency on taxing the wealthy in this state. It's seen as a really volatile source of income for the state. You asked him why he didn't. What did he say?
Yeah, and of course, the Rainy Day Fund was an effort, and so far, although we will see when it happens, whenever the next recession happens, so far a successful effort to guard against some of that volatility. But the fact is, as Jerry Brown said, look, I would say that is not a very fruitful area for gubernatorial leadership, because anytime you deal with this tax system, you know, there's going to be winners and losers and people aren't going to like it. And you generally end up having more taxes come in and there's people who are going to get frustrated and upset about that, voters in particular. But then on CEQA, you know, this is something where, he's called it CEQA reform the Lord's work, talking about the California Environmental Quality Act, which critics can say, and Jerry Brown has said, can make it harder to to build homes, right? And can potentially lead to some of these housing challenges that we have. He's like, well, when you choose, I didn't say to tackle it, do you choose to levitate off your chair? That's not possible. So he points to some powerful interest groups that block it. So he's always been very intentional in choosing his battles, knowing that any elected leader has limited political capital, and he made the most of his.
John, to some other battles that were not complete successes, Brown, of course, a notorious cheapskate, but kind of in the mold of his father, Pat Brown, he had some really big visions for investments in infrastructure in the state, namely the controversial high-speed rail project. It's been mired in delays and budget increases. Funding for the full scope of the project still hasn't materialized. There's also the twin water tunnels that Brown has championed, haven't quite come to fruition. If these projects don't pan out, do you think there could be some blame in Brown's future?
I think there could be some, but I think it's really important to note that neither one of those projects began under Jerry Brown. High-speed rail was talked about back when Pete Wilson was governor, and the voters went to the ballot in 2008 with the backing of Arnold Schwarzenegger to approve the bonds that were the seed money for high-speed rail. And the water project has been going on before that. I think, you know, what's fascinating about those projects, in particular the train project, is that Brown seemed to have lost the symbolism of that. And Jerry Brown is nothing if not a governor who understood the symbol of government. When he came in 2011, he cut cell phones for state workers and cars for state workers to say, we can't afford that. And I was always surprised that he didn't quite see the symbolism or sell the symbolism of the train project better. He certainly, he downsized that train project in a way that made it not cost as much money, but he's never found the funding for it and never found, I think, the hook to convince the public that it's needed. I think those are going to be very tough things for Newsom when he takes office on Monday.
Speaking of when Newsom takes office, you know, he's also a Democrat, but he might not run the same kind of ship as Brown. John, of the campaign promises Governor-elect Newsom made on the trail, which does it look like he's most likely to pursue first?
Well, the first thing that we saw out of the gate was a tip that he's going to spend or going to propose spending, I should say, about $2 billion on early childhood education programs. This is near and dear to a lot of Democrats in the state capitol. I think it's an easy first win. It's not as controversial. Improving kindergarten from part-time day kindergarten to full-day kindergarten, childcare expansion, training of childcare workers. I think that's the first one, and I think that's probably one that shows that he is serious about education issues in the state. This morning we saw a report that he'll spend more on community colleges. I think those are the first ones, but even in the proposal about early childhood education, Megan, Newsom's people will point out the documents that we saw that he wants to propose one-time money. Again, not ongoing funding for these, but a one-time infusion of cash. That notion of how you spend the money, how long the money will last, was a hallmark of the Brown governorship. I think it's going to be part of the Gavin Newsom story as well.
All right, last question for both of you. You both spoke to Governor Brown, went up to his ranch. If you haven't heard Ben Adler's exit interview with Brown at his ranch, it's definitely worth a listen. Here he is asking about the rise in housing prices in California.
There are folks who argue that, you know, this happened on your watch, that this...
What's the it? Did home prices got more expensive?
The California's housing affordability crisis has deepened.
Housing prices
and
got
poverty
more
has
expensive.
Deepened. Yeah, yeah. And to what extent were you as governor responsible
for that?
Your
house got more. Has a higher value now than when you bought it.
So
why don't we cut it in half and make it more affordable? Nobody wants to do that.
All right, Governor Brown, sometimes an adversarial relationship with the press as evidence there. Do you think that Governor-elect Gavin Newsom will be any different, Ben?
You know, that's going to be interesting. I do think that based on some of the things I've heard Newsom say, he thinks that Jerry Brown can get away with more with the press than than he's going to be able to. This is going to be we'll go with one of those journalistic cliches. Only time will tell. You know, John, you had the interview after me. He was pretty feisty with me that day. I would imagine he was perhaps more of the same with you.
He was. He doesn't like to be handled, and I think he was feeling handled through the variety of reporters who wanted to talk to him. I'll say the real difference here, Megan, just in talking about this, is the simple fact that Jerry Brown, I felt long, always as a reporter with him, did not need the news media. I mean, Jerry Brown had a 40-plus year relationship with California voters. They knew who he was. They, you know, dealt with his quirks, his oddities, and so he didn't need to come out and explain his message much. I think Newsom is a more traditional politician. He's going to want to explain that message. He's going to want to communicate through the press. I don't know that it'll be a friendlier relationship, but I think we will see him more.
All right, Ben Adler, Capitol Bureau Chief for Capitol Public Radio, and John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
You're back with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. A whole new wave of congressional members were sworn into office yesterday. Among them was Harley Ruda, the new representative for California's 48th district in Orange County. After a tight race, Ruda unseated 15-term Republican incumbent Dana Rohrabacher, flipping the Orange County district in that notorious blue wave last November. Ruda takes office at an interesting time. There's the divide between Republicans and Democrats, sometimes unpredictable White House, and, well, yeah, the government is shut down. The democratically controlled House did come together Thursday to pass a spending bill to end the shutdown and reopen the government, though a vote seems unlikely in the Senate. In the midst of that House vote yesterday afternoon, Ruda made some time to speak with us and explained why he voted in support of the bill.
The goal here is to basically mimic almost identically the appropriation bills that were passed by the Senate just a couple weeks ago. We are going to approve that here at the House, and we are hopeful that the Senate will repeat what they did a couple weeks ago so we can get this in front of the president, and hopefully he will reconsider his current behavior and sign the bill.
Negotiations with the White House have stalled over funding for the border wall. How much are you willing to compromise on border security, and does that include any more money for a border wall?
Well, that's the thing. We need to separate border security from a border wall. A wall is a medieval technology that doesn't work in today's world. What we need today is fencing and technological advances such as drones, as well as feet on the street that are able to monitor the border and our ports. The fact that we've got a president throwing a temper tantrum over the inability to build an outdated wall is unfortunate for American taxpayers.
You are a former Republican who ran and won as a Democrat, representing a district in Orange County that has a registration advantage for Republicans, and you've said that you hope to transcend polarizing politics and reach across the aisle. Where do you see opportunities, if anywhere, to do that?
I think there's a lot of opportunities. First and foremost, at the top of my list, is hoping that we can address the woefully inadequate dedication of resources to infrastructure in our country. The U.S. spends about 2.5% of GDP on infrastructure. That's about half of what European Union nations spend and about a third of what China is spending. And we recognize that we need to up our game in that regard. It's also an opportunity to begin to address climate change, because infrastructure has such an important role in either addressing climate change in a positive way or a negative way, depending on how it's implemented. I also believe we can find bipartisan support for immigration and border security. We just need to bring common sense to the table. And there's certainly other areas as well that continue to encourage development of our economy and creating jobs.
But things haven't exactly started off on a warm and fuzzy note there in Washington, getting sworn in the middle of a government shutdown. How do you think the two sides can come together after this?
Well, that's the interesting thing. So when you look at these appropriation bills that we're putting on the table, again, they were just approved, and now you have it's going to pass the House. So why the president would refuse to support these appropriation bills and allow us then to focus on the debate about how to properly secure our border is nothing short of throwing a temper tantrum. And that's not what we expect from the president of the United States. And I'm hoping he comes to his senses and does just that.
One issue that is potentially polarizing is how aggressive this Congress will be when it comes to watchdogging the president. Speaker Pelosi has struck a fairly cautious tone there, but not all other Democrats are on board. There's already talk about introducing articles of impeachment, further investigations, getting his tax returns. What approach do you support?
I've supported all along that we need to make sure that Mueller has the time to do the breadth and depth that his investigation deserves. And once we see that, whether action should be taken or not, I will hold my judgment until that time. I think that's the right way to go. But if there are certainly indications that we need to do what we were elected to do under Article 1 of the Constitution of the United States of America, then I'm prepared to do that.
Assuming you are eventually able to move past this shutdown, what else is at the top of your agenda now that you're in office? What are the priorities for your district?
From a local standpoint, we have several issues. One is addressing sober home issues in the area, the noise from John Wayne Airport, San Onofre, the nuclear power plant that was shut down, and the radioactive waste that's still sitting on our coastline and not being addressed. Gun violence is another one that's both nationally and locally affecting us, and healthcare as well.
There are a lot of challenges to that. In the long term, what do you hope to accomplish with a Democratic Congress and a Republican Senate?
I am hopeful, and this may be Pollyannish, but I am hopeful that our country at this point is at the low point of partisan bickering, and we are prepared to stop it and work across the aisle and put country and community first. I truly believe most Americans are between the 20-yard lines. And unfortunately, often the extremes drives the narrative and the dialogue, and the press tends to focus on what separates us. But as elected leaders, our job has to be not to fall into that discourse, but to focus on where we have common ground and move our country and communities forward.
Congressman Harley Ruta is the new representative for California's 48th District in Orange County. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Now to another possible shutdown of sorts. Next Thursday is when LA's unionized teachers plan to strike. That is, if the union, United Teachers Los Angeles, cannot come to terms with the LA Unified School District. The district has offered a 6% raise and additional money to reduce class sizes and hire more nurses and librarians, but the union has said it's not enough. The two sides have agreed to meet again on Monday, but as each day passes without a resolution, a strike seems more and more likely. If it happens, what to do with LAUSD's more than 600,000 students? To find out, we've got Vivian Ekchian on the line. She's the district's deputy superintendent. Welcome to Take Two.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Now let's get down to logistics. If a strike should happen, LAUSD has said that 400 substitutes will be brought in to fill the roles of teachers. That doesn't sound like a whole lot, considering there are more than 600,000 students in the district. How will you determine who goes to what school and how many each school gets?
So thank you for asking that question, because I'm happy to clarify it. First and foremost, the individuals that will be going to school sites to serve as teachers will be administrators that are at the local district, at central office, other employees of the district. The substitutes that we possibly may be outsourcing will be as an extended resource plan. But that is not the first group of individuals that will be serving our schools. They will be current employees that have functioned former as teachers or administrators. That will be the first line of employees going to school sites.
I probably don't have to tell you there are a lot of panicked parents out there. One mom, Brenda Miller, was on our show yesterday and expressed her concerns. Here's what she had to say.
I don't see how there are simply going to be enough substitutes to go around. I'm especially concerned for my kindergartner and what that experience will be like for him. I'm worried that they're going to just be outside in the lunch area all day, because that's the only common area for the students to be in.
Vivian Ekchian, what will the kids' experience be when they go to school, and how many staff members in total will there be deployed?
So we have carefully deployed personalized site by site. Obviously, the experience may not be necessarily exactly the same they have every day, but if we didn't feel that our students would be safe and we wouldn't be able to offer instruction, we would not have been planning for the last almost year. May I just say that I'm very optimistic that with our teachers union coming to the table on Monday, that we will be able to come to resolution. But I understand parent concerns. I've worked in the district for 33 years. I was a TA, I was a teacher, I was a site administrator, and a parent. So I understand that this is an out of the ordinary experience that hasn't happened for 30 years. So I want to share with the parents that we have taken every possible step to make sure that stability at our community sites continues. The entrance to the school will be highly monitored. Students will be welcomed. They will be taken to safe places. We have lessons in advance in grab-and-go kits that we've prepared for months. And the individuals going to the school sites are prepared to be teaching. Now, will it be like any other day of the year? Probably not. But will we make sure that our most prized possessions, our students, are kept safe and comfortable and learning, absolutely.
So what are these lesson plans that have been prepared, which Superintendent Austin Buettner called alternate curriculums? What does that mean, particularly, you know, if this turns into a prolonged strike, how are students going to keep up with learning standards?
So that will be incredibly unfortunate, because obviously what we would love to see the most is our students taught by their valuable teachers. And I know that that is our priority, and we're working towards resolution to that. We have prepared lessons, Common Core lessons based on standards. We have prepared them for a number of days. We have online lessons. We've created age-appropriate lesson plans. But obviously, if this were to happen for a prolonged period of time, there would be negative impact, not just to the students, but to the entire community, their parents, and other employees as well. Because our schools are communities. They're not isolated employee groups coming to function in isolated capacities.
Let's talk about some of the news yesterday. LA Unified's attorneys sued to block some members of the teachers union from striking. This would apply to any UTLA member who provides services to special education students. Why make this move?
So I don't think that is something that is appropriate for me to address from an attorney point of view, because I'm not an attorney, but our concern for students with special needs that have individualized education plans that require very, very specialized services is a concern to the district. Have we planned to make sure that the individuals who have the most knowledge about students with special needs go to the campuses that have the largest number of students with special needs? Absolutely. But are we concerned that that personalization that is dictated in the individualized education plan will be able to occur moment by moment, day by day? We are concerned about that.
UTLA said it would meet with LA Unified officials Monday. What do you expect will come of this?
I am the eternal optimist. I believe in our teachers. I believe in employees that have put so much time and effort in being the people who lead the next generation of students and leaders in our country. I know something positive will come out of it, but we have to have the patience to sit down and discuss it. I know class size is of importance. It is just as important to us. We would like to find solutions without becoming insolvent, and that's what we're working towards. I'm incredibly optimistic and hopeful.
All right. Vivian Ekchim is the LAUSD's deputy superintendent. Thanks so much for being on Take Two.
Thank you. I appreciated the opportunity.
And coming up, we've got the president of the teachers union to talk about how things look from their perspective, and we'll have him answer some questions and concerns. We've heard from parents, plus a controversy in higher education here in Southern California. We'll have that when Take Two returns in just a minute. Back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. A few minutes ago, we spoke with LAUSD Deputy Superintendent Vivian Ekchian and discussed some of the logistics if a teacher strike happens next week. Now we turn to Alex Caputo-Pearl. He's the president of United Teachers Los Angeles. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some news that broke yesterday. LA Unified's attorneys have asked a federal judge to block some members of the teachers union from striking. This would apply to UTLA members who provide services to special education students like teachers, social workers, and therapists. Do you think this move is legal?
Well, this is a legal Hail Mary on their part. And if they really cared about special education students, frankly, they would have agreed to our special education demands at the table. We're trying to lower class size and offer more support in special education classrooms across the city, and they haven't moved one inch on that. So this is a legal Hail Mary that's contradictory to their actions. And frankly, it's consistent with bad behavior at the bargaining table on their part. They're trying to bargain in the media. They're sending confusing messages. They've refused to give us public records. They've tried to bar our members from talking to parents about the issues. So unfortunately, it's bad behavior on their part.
If those special ed workers are indeed blocked from a strike, how does that affect your bargaining power should it come to that?
Special education teachers are not going to be blocked from striking. Like I said, this is a legal Hail Mary. It's going to be thrown out by the courts. What we're looking forward to is Monday. We want to get an agreement, and we're hoping for the best. But we are ready to strike. 98% of our members voted to authorize a strike. We're more highly organized than we've ever been, and we had over 50,000 people, including thousands of parents, out on the street on December 15th. So we're hoping for the best on Monday, but we're ready to strike if we have to.
And what do you hope will come out of that meeting with the district on Monday?
Well, we need the district to give us a commitment. They're going to spend the record-breaking $1.9 billion reserve on student needs. And they've got to engage all of our proposals instead of dismissing them. So, for example, class sizes in L.A. are some of the highest in the state and the country. You have over 45 students in many secondary classes, over 35 students in many elementary classes. You've got 80% of our schools that do not have full-time nurses. We don't have enough counselors. We don't have enough school psychologists. Most school libraries are now not functioning because they don't have librarians. Our students deserve more. So what the district has put on the table, saying that they'll put $30 million towards that staffing, is woefully inadequate. That would provide one additional staff member at only one-third of the schools across the city, and that's just not adequate for our kids.
Charter schools have not been a part of union negotiations, but you have asked publicly for an immediate cap on charter schools, arguing that they tap into LAUSD's already limited resources, they hurt enrollment in traditional public schools. We had an LAUSD parent, Evelyn Aleman, on yesterday. Her daughter goes to Grover Cleveland Charter Magnet in Reseda, which is unionized and is not an independent charter. She alluded to the choices that parents have and what can be done to give them better options. Here were her thoughts.
We have a great school model. My question is, why don't we make that a model for other schools to follow? I think that the district has great schools, and I think we need to focus on how to expand those throughout the district and not focus so much on charter schools.
What's your response to Evelyn's idea to focus on the model of successful LAUSD schools rather than capping charters?
Yeah, first of all, Cleveland High School is a district school. It's not an independent charter school, as you said. We've got great folks over at Cleveland. And frankly, there's great educators teaching in charter and district schools across the city. Here's the issue. The charter school law of 1992, it was designed to actually allow for innovation in a small number of schools that would then provide models and feedback into the system and help public schools overall. Billionaires who lost on vouchers in the 1990s in California took over the charter school law as their vehicle to privatize public education and have privately run entities run public schools. And so they've built an industry behind that. And charter schools have grown at a clip of 287% over the last 10 years, draining $600 million per year out of neighborhood public schools in L.A. That's why we're calling for a cap. It's not a bargainable issue, and it's not an issue that we can legally strike over, but it is absolutely essential for the future of public education in Los Angeles to cap this corporate charter school growth and invest in our existing schools that we already have, district and charter.
That LAUSD parent we spoke with yesterday, Evelyn Aleman, was also a teacher's assistant during the last LAUSD teacher strike in 1989. Here's what she said about the fallout of that strike as she saw it.
We felt that it was disruptive to the school community because it broke a lot of relationships. There was a lot of distrust among the teachers, principal, the parents.
Now, if the strike happens, how do you think teachers and students and parents will bounce back from such a contentious event? What will it take to heal after these negotiations?
Well, we've actually been overwhelmed by the support that we've seen across the city from parents and community organizations. I mean, parents have been a part of this process from 2 years ago, when they were involved in bargaining surveys, as we decided what to take to the table. As I said, thousands of parents on the street with us on December 15th. So there's really been incredible support, and when we win, which we will, it'll be a collective victory around class size, more nurses, more counselors, limiting standardized testing so that we actually have music and the arts and ethnic studies back in the curriculum. These are things that we see this as, you know, whether it takes a strike or not, the victory that we're going to get for public education, we see it as a unifying thing, not as something that is going to break people apart.
Alex Caputo-Pearl is the president of United Teachers Los Angeles. Thanks so much for being on Take Two.
Thanks so much.
Moving on to another education issue, a small Southern California college is currently at the center of a big debate about academic boycotts of Israel. Back in November, the faculty at Pitzer College in Claremont voted in favor of suspending the school's study abroad program with the University of Haifa in Israel, citing concerns over Palestinian rights. The faculty did so in line with a growing and controversial movement called the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Campaign. Here with more is KPCC's religion and diaspora reporter Aaron Schrank. Hey, Aaron.
Morning, Megan. Good to be with you.
So, Aaron, maybe a good place to start is with some broader context. What exactly is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement?
Sure, yeah. So Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, also known as BDS, is a global campaign pressuring companies to cut ties with Israel and promoting various economic, cultural, and academic boycotts of the Israeli state over its treatment of Palestinians. So it was launched in 2005 by a coalition of Palestinian NGOs. The idea is basically to isolate Israel and pressure it into changing policies. Specifically, BDS organizers want Israel to end its military occupation, to guarantee full equality for Palestinian citizens, and to allow Palestinian refugees the right to return to their homes and properties. And as you mentioned, the movement is quite controversial. Some critics see it as an attempt to delegitimize Israel or even as anti-Semitic.
And how did Pitzer College get involved?
So last year, BDS organizers started calling on faculty and others on campuses to uphold an academic boycott of Israel by refusing to participate in study abroad programs there. Campaigners basically say Israeli universities have played a major role in planning and justifying Israel's military occupation of the Palestinian territories. And so in recent months, we've seen two University of Michigan professors refused to write letters of recommendation for students applying to study abroad in Israel. So far, no American universities have actually suspended study abroad programs, so Pitzer College would be the first if that faculty effort is successful.
So the faculty at Pitzer, what exactly does this motion do?
So in November, the Pitzer faculty voted by about 4-to-1 ratio in favor of suspending the college's study abroad program until two things happen. One, the Israeli state ends its restrictions on entry to Israel based on ancestry or political speech. And two, Israel adopts policies that provide visas for students to study at Palestinian universities on a fully equal basis as they do with Israeli universities. I spoke with Pitzer history and anthropology professor Daniel Siegel, who brought the motion forward.
Israel has to have open borders equally for our Palestinian American and Arab American students as it does for all of the rest of our students.
So part of what is at issue here is a 2017 Israeli law that allows the country to bar any foreign boycott supporters from entering. An American student trying to study at Hebrew University was recently denied entry because she'd led a pro-Palestine student group. She appealed that to the Israeli Supreme Court, which actually ruled in her favor and let her in. But the law is still on the books, and many of the Pitzer faculty see that as a problem.
Yeah, I'm guessing that this has elicited quite a lot of reactions.
Yeah, certainly. Perhaps most importantly, Pitzer College's president condemned the faculty motion pretty quickly, saying it would deprive students of academic opportunities and was in conflict with the college's core values. The faculty vote was also denounced by many pro-Israel groups, like the AMCHA Initiative, for example. That's a California nonprofit that monitors anti-Semitism on campuses. AMCHA Director Terry Rossman Benjamin told me faculty should have the right to speak out in favor of a boycott, but actually implementing one on campus is a different story, and she's worried more universities could try and follow suit.
This is not a new issue. What is new with these examples at the University of Michigan and Pitzer College, it's not theoretical. This is actually something that, if it's actually implemented, hurts your own students.
And last month, all 10 University of California chancellors actually signed a joint statement condemning any faculty attempts to implement Israel boycotts on UC campuses. And that seems to be the first such statement by a major university system.
So what happens next at Pitzer?
The November faculty motion wasn't binding, so a Pitzer governance body called the College Council, which is made up of all the faculty there and 20 elected student delegates, must also vote in the coming semester. That vote isn't yet scheduled, but should occur late this month or early next. Pitzer College bylaws seem to say that the president can overrule that group's recommendations, but faculty say that's rarely, if ever, happened. So we'll just have to kind of wait and see how this plays out.
All right, KPCC's religion and diaspora reporter Aaron Schrank talking to us about a faculty movement at Pitzer College to suspend an Israel study abroad program as an act of boycott. Thanks a lot, Aaron.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
Stick around. There's more Take Two coming up in just a minute. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino. The concept is still unfamiliar to a lot of people, but peer-to-peer car sharing is a growing phenomenon in Los Angeles. That's the system where individuals rent their personal vehicles to strangers by the hour, day, or week through services such as Turo, Get Around, even General Motors offers the service. And some people are renting multiple cars, turning themselves into an entrepreneurial miniature form of Hertz. Take Two's motor critic Sue Carpenter brings us the story.
29-year-old Andrew Linjosic bought a 2018 Porsche Boxster for himself just a few months ago. But now?
Fortunately, I'm now renting it 27 or 28 days of the month, so I don't get to drive it as much as I would like to.
He's doing it through a service called Turo, where he rents his car to strangers for about $120 a day, earning himself each month
$1,500 net of all expenses, including depreciation and after taxes.
Couple that with the income he also earns by renting out his Audi A5 coupe, and this whole peer-to-peer car sharing thing is working out pretty well for Linjosic. So he's planning to branch out with another Porsche Boxster, a Chevy Corvette, a Ford Mustang, maybe a Tesla.
I have about 18 cars that I plan to expand to.
Okay. While that does seem ambitious, Linjosic is part of a small but growing number of vehicle owners who started renting their cars to offset the cost of ownership. They do it through different apps, including Turo, Get Around, and Maven. In LA, the vehicles that offer the best return on investment for Turo hosts are the Jeep Wrangler, Fiat 500, and Tesla Model S, according to a new tool on the Turo site called the Carculator, which lets vehicle owners see how much they can earn by renting out their cars. The average earnings for a 2017 vehicle are about $625 per month. Andre Haddad is Turo's CEO.
Cars are incredibly important in people's lives, but they cost a lot of money and are underutilized.
The average cost to own and operate a new vehicle in the United States is about $600 per month, according to the American Automobile Association, factoring in fuel, maintenance, and depreciation, among other things. That's expensive for a lot of people, especially for something that sits idle about 90% of the time and depreciates.
The idea that you're going to let strangers borrow your car for a day is something that just is foreign to everything that we've grown up with.
That's auto industry analyst Rebecca Lindland. She's with the firm Portico Analytics. But for those who've embraced the idea,
you know, it's a great way to get your car to make money for you and become something besides a depreciating asset.
The whole business of peer-to-peer car sharing was signed into California law in 2010, but it's not widely used, Lindland says. Most people still aren't even aware of it. But this is how it works. Like Airbnb, car sharing services pair car owners with people who want to rent a vehicle by the hour, day, or week. The owners list their cars, including information about the make and model, availability, and price. For example, the most popular rental in Los Angeles, according to Turo, is a Jeep Wrangler. It lists for about $90 a day. The apps do take a percentage of that fee, though. ranging from 25% to 40%.
It's been kind of an extension of the gig economy that we're already seeing, and that, folks are looking for ways to have ancillary income.
James Correa is regional manager for Get Around, a car sharing company that operated in Boston and Washington, D.C. before expanding to L.A. a year ago. There are now more than 700 vehicles on its app, a number that is certain to grow since this week Get Around is expanding to include Glendale, Pasadena, Long Beach, and the San Fernando Valley. Correa says so-called micro-entrepreneurs, like Lynn Josick with his Porsche, are on the rise.
We're seeing a little bit more of the micro-entrepreneurs, folks who maybe have more than one car.
Same goes for Maven, the General Motors subsidiary that started adding personally owned vehicles to its car sharing service in L.A. last November.
You know, the sharing economy is really something that's taken off, whether it's in workspace, in travel, in clothing. It's really something that people are embracing.
Kristen Alexander is Maven's marketing manager.
We've already had a few owners on our platform who started off with one and are now adding multiple cars. So they get that it can turn into a mini business that once was just car ownership is now a way to really capitalize on this ability to have passive income.
How much passive income? It depends on the type of car and how often it's rented. But some owners say they earn thousands of dollars per month renting their cars for just a handful of days. In the case of Lynn Josick, who is renting his Porsche Boxster through Turo, he expects to clear $18,000 this year from that one car alone. And by next year, he really does plan to establish that 20-car rental fleet in L.A., Miami, and Toronto. So watch out, Hertz.
Yeah, damn right. Absolutely. And I don't think Hertz has Porsches, so I got one up on them.
Well, it does. But a little competition is healthy, right? For Take Two, I'm Sue Carpenter.
Finally, if you're looking at an empty weekend, we can help you out with that.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Durand. You may be pooped after New Year's, but that is no reason to stay home and nest this weekend because there's so much going on.
So if you're sick of Fortnite and would rather play old school video games, then head to the Fairplex in Pomona this weekend. The Retro City Festival celebrates classic arcade games and console systems. Now my faves, Ms. Pac-Man and Galaga, will be available to play, as well as dozens of other titles like Donkey Kong, Q-Bert, Tempest, and Street Fighter. And if you think you have the chops, enter one of the weekend's many tournaments. Passes for the festival run $25 to $50, and bonus points for this. Children 10 and younger get in free when accompanied by a paid adult.
Meanwhile, it's all fun and games in Costa Mesa, too. This Sunday afternoon, it's Dia de los Reyes, or Three Kings Day. That's to celebrate the Three Wise Men. This thing happens at Segerstrom Center for the Arts, and there will be performances by local high school band ensembles to keep you entertained. Plus, there's going to be storytelling, face painting, crafts, and also, bonus, free Rosca de Reyes, which is King's Cake. And just like the cake, this event is free.
Now, if one of your New Year's resolutions was to get in shape, here's a fun way to keep the exercise interesting. I'm talking about curling, that funky Winter Olympic sport where competitors sweep and brush a heavy stone down a sheet of ice. So on Sunday at 9 a.m., Hollywood Curling holds a pop-up workshop at the rink in downtown Burbank. This is a good chance to learn the basics of the sport outdoors. So wear comfortable shoes and warm clothing. Sneakers are recommended. The session costs $20, and registration information can be found on LAist.com.
Finally, perhaps you need a good recovery after this past holiday, not just from celebrations, but also from technology and distractions. Then tomorrow, go to the LA County Arboretum and Botanic Garden in Arcadia. You can take a session in forest bathing. This is inspired by Japanese practitioners, and what happens is that a guide will walk you through nature, teach you how to better interact with the plants and animals nearby, and really just take it all in. And at the end of the session, take part in a tea ceremony with tea made from plants foraged on site. This thing is for all ages, and tickets are $25 for Arboretum members and $35 for non-members. Now, there's actually so much more to do than just that. You can find our whole list of events on LAist.com. That is LAIST.com.
I'm LAist Christine Ziemba.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And see you
Have
later.
Have a good weekend.
That's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Lori Galarreta and Austin Cross. Audrey Ngo and Julia Paskin helped us out this week. The show is edited by Sue Carpenter. Leo Duran directed the show, and our engineer is Hasmik Pahosian. The senior producer is Megan Larson. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino, and A. Martinez will be back on Monday. We hope you all have a great weekend.